Welcome to Scrappy ABM. This is your podcast with practical playbooks that don't break the bank. In this podcast, we dig into the exact playbooks that ABM practitioners are using today to get their first ABM program off the ground. We'll dig into how they're using their current tech stack in order to create scrappy programs that rely more on creativity than new technologies. So if you're looking for how to get ABM off the ground in your organization in the next 90 days, let's dive into this episode. Hello, in this episode of Scrappy ABM, you're actually going to hear where I was interviewed on somebody else's show. We just love the content so much, we wanted you to hear it and make sure that you got it. So I hope you enjoy this episode of Scrappy ABM.
So right now, you have 14 employees. Most people actively choose to not do the employee thing and to go alone. They have trouble scaling for a bunch of obvious reasons. But you don't need a bunch of people to scale, but sometimes you want to build that kind of business. And so I'd love to understand just like, well, what was the turning point for you? Go out on your own and then decide like, this is the trajectory I want to build.
I'll walk you through it. So I've been using HubSpot since everything. So like I had like a side hustle client that I sold for like 25 grand in March of 23. And then I launched the Scrappy ABM podcast in July of 23, exclusively with the intent of like replacing my wife's income so that she could be a stay-at-home mom. So that was the whole plan, was I was going to do this little teeny tiny side hustle and like keep working. I was the head of demand gen at a sales enablement company. And like, I loved it. It was super fun. And then from when I launched in July, I then sold 45,000. And then the other thing that happened that we haven't talked about, or that I haven't talked about as much publicly, is also in August, I closed a $150,000 deal. I put that in quotes because essentially when I closed that in August and then I went back to my J job in September, I then had essentially 200K in secured revenue. And then I had a pipeline of like $1.5 million. And I was like, I think we're going to leave my day job. Like, I don't think this makes sense anymore, which is when we talked. And then I left my day job. And then that 150K deal backed out. And so it's back down to like 50K in secured revenue. I was like, this sucks. But I already left the day job. But luckily, the pipeline was real. So then from September to October, we closed another 100K. And then it was like another 40. And then in December, I closed another like 140-ish K.
And when you're saying this real quick, so like, I appreciate you just airing it all out.
Yeah.
When you say that, like, is that collected one time? Is that like retainer revenue? Is that, that's...
Yeah. So I didn't know what I was doing because I didn't plan to have a business. So like, I just did stuff. And like the first pitch deck was literally, here is everything that I can do. And then some people picked, like the first pitch deck had 16 different service lines, which is dumb.
That'll happen.
I don't know if you know, like that's really stupid. And now we have two service lines. So for like, for context, less is more. It's like way easier to sell when you do like one thing or two things. So this was a lot of project revenue. And then we talked about this concept of the activation playbook. And I think it was in December of 23 that somebody was like, I love this playbook concept. Could we just do like one a month ongoing? And I was like, oh, that's an interesting idea. So I then made a retainer model. So like all of this up until this point was largely project revenue. And then I had one, it was in October, I secured one annual contract that was $80,000. And we live in Cornfield in Indiana. So it's really easy to live cheaply. Like actually, I still live on a budget to exist. We need like $3,000 a month.
Well, I know you're openly a big baby steps and Ramsey guy. Yeah. I've also
we're baby step seven.
God bless. Congrats, man. That's a huge achievement, accomplishment. Having gone through it myself, I know that doing that work changes your life in a lot of ways.
Yes.
Not seven yet. Four, five, six, but getting there.
So to answer your initial question, none of this was like retainer revenue, and this was not cash collected. So like in the year 2023, I actually only cash collected in our business account $66,000. And I didn't set up a business account until July, but like still, it was not, I think we cash collected $80,000 in like the year 2023. So most of this December was sold for work to then be done the following year.
Were you selling this on the idea that you were going to do all the delivery? Was the plan to always find other talented people to help you do it? Or
no, I want to remind everybody, like the plan here in July was launch a little side hustle. Yeah. And the plan then in September was like, I think I could leave my day job. And then the plan in October, November, and then December was, oh, I think I have a business.
This could work.
So in December, I hired like a business coach. And side note, if you hire a coach, fire a coach quickly. And I say that from the perspective of a guy that like, I got what I needed from my coach in like 4 months, but then I kept around for nine because I really liked the guy, but it just is a waste of money after the first four for me personally. So I hired a coach though. And then in January, actually like mapped out an organizational vision and mission and like the idea of an org chart and like core values and all that kind of stuff. Because I was like, I think this is a real business at this point. And then, you know, the story I tell is it was like January, I hired a contractor and it was wild for me because I was charging a client like $100 an hour and I was working 80 hours a month for them. So then I hired a contractor and I was like, hey, what if I paid you $70 an hour for 65 hours a month? And he was like, that sounds great. And that was the first time I was like, whoa, I literally just bought back 65 hours of my time. I get $15, yeah, it's like $30 an hour margin on his time for not having to do anything. And then I'm still involved 15 hours a month for meetings and strategy and making sure he's doing the right stuff. This is awesome. So then I just was like, I should do that more because that sounds great.
Yeah.
So we kept closing things slowly. And then we had a solid uptick in April.
How are you acquiring clients real quick? Like, where were these clients coming from?
LinkedIn, and I had a podcast.
So you were drinking your own whiskey and
Yeah. Like, I just did the same stuff I told everybody else to do, which is shocking. It worked.
funny how that happens.
So from like October until March, I only had like the one contractor that was working for me for like 60 hours a month. And he started in January. And then I had another guy that would help me out on like op stuff for like 8 hours a month. So for context, we got up to like 50 to 60 grand in revenue coming in per month with like me and like 2 80-hour-a-month contractors, which is stupid because I was working like 120-hour weeks. And then my loving wife, who was postpartum, was working 20 to 30 hours for free editing podcasts. So like it was a family endeavor to build up the bank account because before I hired people, I wanted a stacked bank account. So it was in April that I was like, I want to hire some more contractors. So I hired a bunch of people part-time as contractors and then they all scaled to be full-time by July. And then when July hit, we then went on a tear, as people can see.
Yeah. I mean, just looking at the chart is bananas. There's like a million little decisions that you make along the way. And I think some people agonize over. So, for example, one that I'm interested in is contractor versus W-2. How did you decide on which way to go and that it was best for the business to ultimately bring people on that way? And then you've also talked about a few false starts that you've had, like that didn't work out so great. Like you've hired too many people at once and that like puts a ton of drag on the company. So I'm curious, like, how you thought about all that and worked through that.
So for charters with contractors, it was, I needed help and I literally didn't know how to legally hire people as W-2. So that was just easier to get it started. And then I ended up going to a fractional HR company that started with us in July. And I was like, hey, I have a bunch of contractors that want to work here as FTEs. Can we get them set up as W-2 employees starting January 1st?
Yeah, that sounds great.
So I always had the intent to inevitably transition from contractor to W-2 when I even hired these people. And I just said, this is a contract to hire role. We're a 6-month-old company. So like when I would interview people, I would say, I literally don't know how to hire W-2 employees. I'm working on it. So we will get there. But like, I need help now and you need work. So do you want to do it? And they're like, yeah, that's great. So really not that complicated, shockingly honest and simple, but it worked.
Shockingly honest.
Yeah, like I'm a good marketer and now I have to figure out how to be a business owner.
That's a bigger shift.
Yeah, it's huge. And what I will call out, and like, this is what I know now, I've learned a lot of lessons on this front. So like one, people that are willing to work as part-time contractors as like essentially a day job were not the best talent because they couldn't find other things. So like everyone that we hired, other than two, I fired 7 people because they were not good. They didn't have other employment. They could not get other employment and they didn't know how to do the job.
So this is interesting. And I've seen this play out in two ways. One is the way that you're describing. The other way is actually that you end up building a business with what I describe as like an army of entrepreneurs, like the high caliber, like high octane people who are highly motivated. Not that W-2 employees aren't, but like, as you know, being an entrepreneur, it's a different game to play. And the work you have to do to keep going, like you have to earn your business every single day in a different way. And so I've found that some people have been very successful with like that army of entrepreneurs and to kind of not own a portion of their portfolio, but like for lack of a better term, right? They have a solid chunk of their time dedicated to their business and their clients.
So what I would throw out is I did not hire what I would refer to as like professional contractors or freelancers. I hired people that were W-2 employees previously and either did this as a side hustle or didn't have another job. And they were not entrepreneurial in their mindset. It was more of a tax status for them. So I just want to call out, you're correct in the sense of I learned that lesson. And then the other thing that I just did is as we went on this tear, I mean, it has been, so for context, from October. So the story I always tell is like by October 2024, we sold $1 million, which is great.
So that's like a little over a year from March 23 to October 24. So a year and a half-ish, the road to a million. Well, you're not full-time, but like from the first time that a client closed till then.
Yeah, full-time essentially was a year.
Yeah.
Because I stepped out here. So then within essentially a year, full-time, we sold $1 million. And then in the trailing 3 months after that, we sold another $1 million.
What do you think contributes to this? Like there have been people who are at it for a very long time that haven't put up numbers like this. And I'm curious from your perspective, like, is it just the courage to ask for a very high value project and or retainer number? Like, what do you think contributes to being able to put up numbers like that?
There's a lot of things. So like thing one is I had been talking publicly about account-based marketing for 3.5 to 4 years before I launched my own business.
Highly conditioned market for sure.
Yeah, like people already generally knew me in the space. So essentially, even though I incorporated Scrappy ABM at a certain point in time, I had essentially been running Scrappy ABM for free through content and through hopping on consulting calls just to be helpful for 3 years. So what it felt like is I essentially just said, hey, my doors are open now and I actually do this for a living. That's really all that changed.
So a lot of pent up demand.
Yeah. Because like the other thing that people get, like this was all inbound. I've actually not gone outbound for a sale ever.
Well, you're a highly relationship-driven person. Like, long before this existed, you were doing the marketing ladder, trying very hard to meet a lot of people. You were always putting posts together to bring more people together, to help other people find jobs. Like, you have always spent a lot of time leaning into the relational side of building a business or just being a human, right? Like, it wasn't ever about traffic, or at least from the outside looking at it, it doesn't look like it's about traffic. It's about building relationships. And I think this is all of that. This is the culmination of all of that. Like, yeah. Everyone knew you. This is an outcome of the years that you put in to building relationships with people.
Yes. And the core thing that I would say is different from the thing that I have continued to do is I still do speaking engagements whenever asked, and I don't charge for that, because for me, the opportunity to go is more important than the $2,000 that I would get as a speaking fee. I say yes to every podcast interview that is still asked of me, just as a standard, because I also repurpose a lot of that content for our own show. I still do networking calls where there's no ask or no sale. And I do an absurd number of webinars. Like, for context, if we flash forward a little bit to, I forgot agency sales cycles because this was really slow because it was year one. And then, like, I did a million in sales in the first full year. And then 3 months later, I did another million in sales. So I was like, God, it's like, we're just going to be on an incredible upward trend and tear. And I forgot, like, oh yeah, there's like a sales cycle here. And there is seasonality, at least in my past experience in agency space. Totally. So we've actually been pretty flat on growth for like all of the summer.
Right now you're delivering on that, on all that work though.
Yeah. So when this flat happened, I was like, crap. So I, in the past 60 days, have done 60 podcast interviews and 18 webinars. And now it's been the past 2 weeks. So it's right after 4th of July. We generated over 2 million in pipeline in 2 weeks because I went out and went insane on content creation and relationship and networking, so that when people's second half of your budgets opened up, I have literally been people's first call. And then there were plenty of people here, specifically January to March, that wanted to start in Q2, but had deals slip or had budget slip from Q2 that then said, well, I think I can get started in Q3. And a lot of people have already come back around. So as I look at this, we're here just a year later. Mm-hmm. So given the pipeline volume that we've already created, I feel fairly confident we'll have a great August. We'll have an uptick in September, an uptick in October, and then we'll have a gangbusters experience November to March. And that is then the second lesson on hiring that I learned, which is because I had such a bad experience with contractors previously, I immediately went for W-2, round two, and I expected this trend line to continue, and it hasn't. So we're going to be fine, but like, Q3 is not going to look great for us on like a cash flow perspective, because I've got fixed costs and we have not continued to sell to backfill some of those fixed costs for like 3 months. Pipeline wasn't there. So my new lesson is having a bunch of contractors that are professional contractors where you pay a premium, but you don't commit yourself to significant fixed costs.
You can scale capacity up and down pretty quick on the extreme ends or whatever.
Yeah. And like, I still want our team, that's the Scrappy ABM branded team, whatever, to be the front facing people for meetings and things. But like, if I have a deep RevOps expert, admittedly, our client doesn't super care if it's a Scrappy ABM employee or a contractor that presses the keys. What they care about is this a Scrappy ABM approved strategy? And we have enough strategists in our team that we can build every strategy, and then we can work with contractors on content and RevOps to actually execute on the programs. So moving forward, because also the other component, sorry to go nerdy for a moment.
Oh, you're good.
Like, the hardest scale from my perspective is going from one dedicated team to two dedicated teams. Because now, once we've actually gotten to two dedicated teams, if they're both fully at capacity, we could actually hire a third team and still be profitable on all of them. The margins would be razor thin. But like when you have only one team, you actually have to pre-sell. So here, this is going to sound bad, but it's in retrospect. I sold deals in February and March, and then based on the close, hired a person. Because I didn't have a team to actually do the delivery on these deals yet. So we kicked out the kickoffs like 3 or 4 weeks. I had really late stage interviews. As soon as the deal would close, I would hire a person. So like, then they were just essentially getting trained. So they're not all trained up. They've been in seat for 6 months. But now we've got to go backfill this capacity. So we're operating right now at probably 60% capacity, which is not awesome. But we've got the pipeline and we're about to hit another significant upward trend because that's just the seasonality. So like, I've learned a lot now on hiring. And I think that this is probably the right path. And I've talked to a lot of other service-based businesses where in that weird in-between stage, it's just having a really solid bench of great contractors that fill in gaps. And you just say to them on the front end, there's going to be a quarterly agreement. When we scale further, I'm going to fire you and replace you with an FTE. It's like, just as a heads up, this is like a 3 to 6 month engagement. You cool with that? Most people are cool with that because they're contractors and like, this sounds great. And they get paid very well.
They're like, this is my entire business.
Yeah. Like this is the game. And they get paid very well for that. But I don't have to stress about a layoff. I don't want to be super clear. We're not stressing about that right now. But if I don't sell, like if I didn't sell anything in Q3, which is insanely unlikely, but if I made zero sales in Q3, like Q4 would be very bad.
Yeah.
How have you managed the shift from I sell it, I deliver it, to I sell it, the team delivers it, right? Like a thing that a mental hurdle for a lot of people is like that they're buying into me. They want me. And not like an egotistical they want me way, but like you are the brand and you built the thing. And so people struggle with that. And I think this is the stigma or like whatever around a more traditional agency model. I know it's not impossible to do it. Many people have done it before us and like people will continue to do it. You're currently doing it. But I'm curious, how did you navigate that shift? And is that something that we were concerned about?
So when I hired contractors, I was still involved in everything. So like I was a primary strategist and I was client facing. But then when I hired FTEs that were like, good. Sounds as horrible as that sounds to say.
I mean, it just is what it is.
But like when I hired talent, the people I hired, I believe are genuinely better at the skill than I am. And for context, all of our clients that build ABM programs with us get a dedicated team of 4 people. So I might be good, but I'm not better than 4 specialists. There's just no way that I am. I can't be. Yeah. I can't be the best expert at content and RevOps and strategy and account management and project management. There's just no way. So when I genuinely believe that they will be better served by not working with me directly and by working with this really great team that I've like hired and vetted and trained, it's not a hard sell. And the other thing that's been helpful, we talked about this just a second ago. I've got baby number 2 on the way. So I had to figure out how to scale myself out of things because I want to take a 2-month paternity leave to be present for my family. So we hired an account executive. So now I'm not even on the first 2 sales calls. I'm only on the closing call to validate and answer questions. And now I've actually fully scaled out of client delivery and most of selling. So now that expectation is actually overcome on the first call because I'm not on the first call anymore.
Was letting go hard?
In certain ways, for sure, because I want to be super clear. I'm really good at selling. Like, it is very much so my skill set because I'm deeply passionate about this stuff. And like, my excitement and enthusiasm wears off on prospects. And they're like, golly, like, this guy is so convicted that this is going to be helpful for us. And I am. I actually know this stuff works. I'm doing it for myself. Like, this is not like a snake oil. It's like, I just scaled a business to 200K MRR in 18 months and it's bootstrapped.
That's like the point, right? Like, no one's going to love your baby more than you do.
So, but that said, like, my account executive that I hired is a guy named Jim Gilkey. Jim has hosted a podcast for 4 years on account-based marketing. He was a marketing director that was so successful building an ABM program. Terminus poached him to be an AE. He was in the top three AE at Terminus for 2.5 years. And then he got recruited over to the CS and account management side. Jim, as an AE, has been in ABM in marketing, sales, and customer success in the past 6 years. And has hosted a podcast. So he can sell both sides of the business. So again, it's not hypothetical. I legitimately hire people that I actually think are better at the job than I would be. So when I then delegate to them, it's actually something I can delegate. And I know that they will do it better than me. So it's sales has probably been the hardest thing for me to give up because it's also the lifeblood of the business. But like, in an ironic sense, having a baby that's almost here has been a forcing function. Because I want to take off for 8 weeks. I've been preparing to take off for 8 weeks for all of September and October since January. So all of this year has just been ramping up a team and scaling myself out of things so that then I can be super present for my family, which we all claim we build these businesses to be present for our families and take care of our families, but then we get consumed by them. So like
guilty.
I'm trying to do it. And who knows? I may come back from paternity leave in November and I may not have a business anymore. And that's fine. You know, I'll figure it out from there.
I doubt that, but it's a possible, I guess it's an option.
I mean, it'll be the first time that I've stepped away for more than a week. Even when I stepped away for a week, I still took a couple calls here and there. So like, you know, we'll see.
But you have, I would imagine you have a right hand, like there's a second in command somewhere that you're not going to vaporize into dust.
Yeah. His name is Greg Toler. Greg is our COO. He is a former CMO that's led multiple companies through acquisitions, and he helped build all of our systems and processes. And like, I've now worked with Greg and known Greg for, we've done stuff off and on together in different organizations, but I've known Greg for like 5 years. And like, when we were building some aspects of the business, like he flew up here and like stayed in my house in the guest bedroom and like hung out with our family. Like
that close.
I like Greg a lot. I like Jim a lot.
You should. Yeah. If you're going to trust him with your business.
Yeah. So like the talent's impeccable. So it's truly going to be easy to step away.
Who was the most impactful hire that like created this space for you? You referenced like buy back your time, right? Like who made the biggest difference for you? A lot of people think EAs, a lot of people think contractors. Who was that for you?
Greg.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
I'm not process oriented. And we are a business that just develops processes. So like what I would do is I'd word vomit stuff at Greg and then Greg would turn it into a framework. And like, that now became the foundation of how we talk and publicly promote the business is we only speak about the frameworks that we use to execute. That's not actually my skill set. I've gotten better at it because I spent a lot of time with Greg and Greg's like just a framework wizard. But like my skill set is people, his is processes. And in order to scale a business, you need processes. So
classic visionary integrator.
Yeah.
Collab.
It's that exactly. So I'd actually tell somebody like the people that I trust in my life, it's like my wife and then Greg. So if that shows you anything, he's great.
So I want to go back. You talked about hiring a coach and you said that you let them overstay their welcome or what, not in so many words, right? You're like, I let them hang around longer than I needed to. What difference did having a coach make for you? Because I think there's this other idea that like not everyone seeks help. So what was your motivation to seek help? How'd you know? And then have you worked with people since?
So I'll go ahead and give the quick context of the coach that I hired. So like I'm very openly a Christian and he was a believer that had built and sold a couple agencies previously and specifically followed a thing called System and Soul that was designed to how do you build a business and good systems that also take care of the souls within them. Everything about that is like, that's exactly what I would like to do.
It's all the boxes, yeah.
Yeah, so like, and it's very similar to EOS in some ways. So that was helpful. And when I think back on it, what did I need help with? I needed help creating a vision and a mission that was larger than can Mason eat? And I needed help thinking through an org chart and
And I know that it sounds odd, but just like when you map out the roles in the organization and then you see all the seats that you currently fill, you're like, got it. So like when I went to go hire people, I just hired based on the org chart. And then I literally removed myself from a seat. It was awesome. So it was the most helpful thing from a hiring roadmap perspective of just like, these are all the roles that I sit in, what it takes up my most time, what am I also really bad at, and what do I hate? And I just bought back all my time. So did that. But I mean, I kept him around for 9 months. And like we would try to do a quarterly review thing, but it was meant for like a leadership team. And at the time, the first one was like me and my wife. And I love my wife, but my wife is a nurse. And she was mainly there because she was like, you paid $3,000 for this. We should probably have someone else show up for you. In Q2, we never did it. We couldn't get it scheduled because the other person that was on our leadership team-ish had a full-time day job. So like we could never get it scheduled with them. And then in Q3, I did it by myself. So like it was supposed to be a leadership thing for like quarterly alignment and whatever. And we didn't have a leadership team. So I should have just had the help on the front end and not the ongoing help. And then the other thing is I liked him because he had built and sold multiple agencies. What I then later learned is I outgrew him in my first year. He had never broken a 7-figure mark. So when I looked at trying to build a business, I wanted to be guided by people that had already been there and done that. So when I transitioned away from that coach, I've now done the acquisition.com workshop. So I've gone out to Vegas. Now I did their initial workshop and then I did their upsell. So they've analyzed our business and told us all the ways that we suck, which has been super helpful. And we're going back again in October. And then I also joined a thing called C12, which is Christian business leaders that get together once a month for a full day. And the guys in that group are non-competitive, but they all have, I'm the smallest business in the room. And there are a couple of people in there that I would consider to be somewhat significantly heavy hitters. Like there's a guy in there that's a $1 billion business, that's third generation. There's another guy in there that owns, and I can't say names because of NDAs, but like there's another guy that owns a consulting AI business that's been super helpful for me as I think through AI implementation in our business. And then there are a couple of guys in there that either run family offices or run private equity groups that have done massive investments. So they are significant heavy hitters. And then I'm just a guy that like runs a small marketing agency and none of them know how to do marketing. So like I help them learn how to do marketing and then they help me figure out how to be a business owner. And like, it's been a very mutually beneficial relationship.
There's a lot to be said for who you surround yourself with. Like surrounding yourself with entrepreneurs is one thing. Surrounding yourself with entrepreneurs that like a whole, that caliber, whole other masterclass. You can't like buy that education.
Yes. There was a minimum revenue that you had to be, and it's $2 million a year. So I barely scraped by. And that's exactly how I wanted it. Because if I am barely able to qualify to be even in the room, that means that the caliber of people are exponentially greater than me. And that's what I was hoping for.
Literally every single thing in there is going to be helpful.
Yep.
There's nowhere to go but up. So no private coaching, but like, so a lot of community-based stuff, but building more like mentors and kind of in groups and stuff has been
the thing. Yeah. And like specifically on mentors, this is going to sound really odd, but like, Hermosi talks about this a lot publicly, of there's a lonely season. So like I had not yet built a business of any substance. So there were people that I would have loved to meet with, but I wasn't there yet. I wasn't on anybody's radar. Now that I've built a business that I'll do $2.5 million this year. And again, that's in like 2.5 years. So it's not just that I built a $2.5 million business. It's that I did it and it happened quickly. And that amount of work has caught attention from a couple of people. So I now meet with once a month, a CEO that just sold his insurance tech company for $120 million. I meet with a CMO that has scaled 4 businesses to 8 figures in 2 years or less each time. And now he runs his own company. So he and I meet once a month. So I've got other people that are mentors that are much further along in their journeys and their careers that I meet with. And I got the access to those people because I built something that was interesting that people were like, shoot, this guy's actually like doing something interesting. And again, I'm early in my journey. So people also see a lot of themselves early in their journey in me. and they want to give back because people give back to them. So you use what you got. And like, I've got, I don't know what I'm doing.
Nobody does.
I especially don't know what I'm doing.
Well, I guess the people you're talking to, they might know what they're doing, but
they know a lot more than I do. So again, I use what I have, which is I have LinkedIn. I know how to do podcasting. I know how to be humble enough to say very publicly and repeatedly, I'm not 100% sure what I'm doing at the moment. I know how to market. I know how to sell. And I've hired wildly talented people that I can actually delegate to. Now the job is building a culture of being a leader worth following. And those are things that I get to learn by being around really great leaders that have built way bigger businesses that have had employees that have stuck around for 10, 15, 20 years. I haven't done that yet, but I'm learning how to do that.
What's the end game for you? What's your goal here?
Mission statement or vision statement is to equip 1 million marketers by January of 2035 with repeatable account-based playbooks so they can be successful in their jobs or their respect of their peers and provide for their families. So the end game, I don't know that past January 2035, but I sure do know that we'll build an education company that enables and equips literally 1 million people. And we're starting to track that like very tangibly. We're at about 2,000 right now, 2 years in, but I expect exponential growth on that. So that's the 10-year end game. And then past that, I reserve the right to figure out what the next 10-year end game is.
I'm curious if you have any vision of selling this thing one day, or more so, do you see this as like a legacy thing? And like, you know, maybe the kids run it, right?
Well, my daughter's 2.
Yeah, I mean, she got some time.
I don't know about that.
You got some time. Who knows what life will look like, but...
Earlier in the year, I got an offer to buy the business, and it was going to be a payout of about $6 to $7 million. And I'm like, 2 years in. So to work for 2 years and to earn $6 or $7 million after a 1 to 2 year earnout, not a bad run. And I didn't take it. So I had to put that box away because I get approached a couple times a week, and I don't want that yet. I might, but I don't see that at least until I've hit 10 million in ARR, because at that point, I think we can scale an ABM business to 8 figures. It's after the 8-figure mark that I got to figure out how to further expand, because at that point, continued growth will come from additional service lines. So that'll be either when I sell or rebrand.
Turning down $6 or $7 million has got to be one of the tougher decisions. And like, I guess maybe it wasn't super tough, but probably a decision you never really considered you'd have to make in life. What was the motivation to say no? I think a lot of people would have jumped at the opportunity. And I mean, $6 or $7 million, if you're a good steward of that.
Yeah, it was done.
You're done. You're good for life. Your kids are probably set for life if you manage it well and your expenses are low.
I mean, the honest motivation is we just started on the mission. Like I just finally got the business set up to a point where I was like, I can actually go spend more time on the education side and teaching and training people that will never have to pay me. And that's way more exciting to me personally. And if I were to have sold, it would have been because I needed to then scale from 2 million to 10 within 2 years. And that may still happen. That'd be cool. But I like my current growth philosophy, which is completely debt-free, and I grow as the market demands. So like, if the market isn't demanding, that's fine. I'm not stressed about it, because so long as I'm happy, which I'm super happy.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
I don't need more. So I just like this. And I want to be super clear, this is not a lifestyle business. By any stretch of the imagination, I still work 60, 80 hour weeks, but I like it. Like, I enjoy what I do. So this is my hobby, and I enjoy being my own boss. Now, again, that may change over time. There may be someone that offers me $20 million, at which point I'd be like, all right, that sounds cool. but for now, I'm good.
I think hearing you describe like the growth philosophy, and you're like, I don't need more. Like, we're building, I think, something with enduring value, and this isn't about getting a cash out or a payday. That level of missionary mindset, I get why people are drawn to to you and to wanting to build this with you or to be a part of it and to like buy into the work that you do. I mean, I don't think enough people consider all these little decisions and things that happen along the way and what it really takes to go from one or two people to 14 employees. I mean, to shift Mason from Mason the marketer to Mason the CEO. Like, people put CEO in their title a lot when it's just them. And no, like, you are an actual CEO. You're in a business here now.
I didn't take on the title of CEO until January because I didn't want it to be a fake title. And I only gave myself the title because I promoted someone to COO. So technically, someone else was an executive before I claimed being CEO. I was like, crap, I screwed that up. Yeah, I wanted the title of CEO to be a respected title. So I went with just founder for like 2 years or a year and a half.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have a business now. It's cool to watch you build it, man. It really is. It's inspiring. And I think what you've done is a lot bigger than what most people dream of doing. And I think it's fun to hear you tell this story because it unlocks like a whole new layer of thinking for people. It's like, oh, it can be more than this. Let's end here. I think for you, you generate the vast majority of the pipeline by going out and telling the story and going on shows and doing the webinars and stuff. I think that might be the final frontier of delegation and like how you get other people. How do you bring up other people? Is that something that's on your radar as you continue to like build this thing out and bring up more voices in ABM and help them start contributing to the pipeline so that, like, again, that's probably takes up a ton of your time and you love doing it for sure. But
you already referenced Ramsey. I think a lot about the Ramsey Solutions model, which is it was essentially just Dave Ramsey, like the first 15 to 20 years. And then in the past 10 to 15 years, he's raised up multiple other voices that he can then amplify with his platform. But Dave has been very public. He plans to retire in the next like 3 to 5 years. So they've been doing legacy and transition planning for the past 10 to 15. So we're already starting to do little things like that. So for example, so people don't know this, I have my podcast, which is our largest show, obviously, because like we put the most time, energy, and effort into that one. But like our account executive, we actually now produce this show and it's sponsored by Scrappy ABM. I'm lead content strategist. He just launched a show called The Content Crowd. And then my head of podcast strategy has a show called Selling Through Social. So we have 4 podcasts for a team of 15 people. And we all produce content very publicly on LinkedIn. I'm doing a training on how to do LinkedIn in the next little bit. But overall, like we are focused on first and foremost building my personal brand. But then as we do that, I then have a larger stage that I can spotlight other people and then help them build their own stages.
Love it, man. It's cool. Thanks for coming on, dude, and sharing your story with me.
Happy to do it.
I think you've unlocked a couple new layers of what's possible for people. So it's super inspiring, dude. And I appreciate it very much, like for not holding anything back and that level of transparency. You don't see it very often. And so for that, I thank you, man.
Of course. Happy to be helpful for anybody that wants to dig in more. Feel free to shoot me a message on LinkedIn.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Scrappy ABM. If you're looking for more content just like this, I highly recommend you go subscribe to our newsletter. We release weekly playbooks so that you have the actionable ways in which you can start to build an ABM program today. Just go to scrappyabm.com/newsletter to subscribe. And if you enjoyed this episode, we'd really appreciate if you'd leave a 5-star review and hit the notification bell so you never miss an episode. I look forward to seeing you in the next one.